we're not really sure how quick the process will pick back up and give them the services that they need so desperately.
The federal government lifts the state's Medicaid moratorium. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 28th of August. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Alaskan auto dealers assess the Cash for Clunkers program.
They were things where you went, was that on the road? I mean, it was that kind of inventory. People who had been putting it off.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Learn more at rasmussen.org.
The federal government has lifted its moratorium on the state's authority to accept applications for four Medicaid waiver programs that give at-home and community-based services for people who would otherwise be confined to assisted living or nursing homes. The moratorium was put in place 2 months ago after a federal review found that, among other deficiencies, a backlog of nearly 2,000 people waiting for evaluations. Since then, the Division of Seniors and Disabilities Services has increased its staff and made internal changes to meet the federal requirements.
The moratorium is lifted, and that's excellent news, and we've worked very, very hard to get to this point.
That's Rebecca Hilgendorf, the division's director. The Department of Health and Social Services was notified this morning in a brief letter that cited the progress and changes that have been made. But the letter also mentions that there is more work to be done, and Hilgendorf says they're committed to making improvements to the system.
We assured the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that we would continue in developing and refining our corrective action plan, which is due to them on September 3rd, on or before September 3rd.
Hilgendorf says she anticipates it will take up to 18 months to complete the work outlined in the corrective action plan. Attorneys recently sought a temporary restraining order against the federal moratorium on Medicaid waivers, but even now that the moratorium is lifted, they say litigation in the case is not dead. A hearing this morning in federal district court in Anchorage only lasted 40 minutes or so, but it gave Judge Timothy Burgess the information he needed to grant attorneys for both sides a two-week assessment period. Mark Regan with the Disability Law Center of Alaska went in prepared to argue for a restraining order against the federal moratorium, although arguments became unnecessary because of the unexpected removal of the ban. Regan said the hearing was valuable anyway in that statements from both sides of the case were made publicly. Regan represents two of the plaintiffs.
Now, what's going to happen next in the court case is that we are going to probably talk with the federal attorneys and the state attorneys about keeping the court case going and having some kind of agreement that a moratorium won't come back without advance notice.
Federal health officials asked the state about problems with the waiver program back in June, Regan said, making the point that without the waivers, the state has no alternative plan for the Division of Senior and Disability Services to provide home care help to those able to move out of assisted living or nursing homes.
One thing that we may be asking for is a commitment on the part of the federal agency and of the state agency not to freeze applications again without some notice and opportunity to go back before Judge Burgess and talk about whether that's a legal thing for them to do. Because it's the continuing position of the plaintiffs in the court case that there wasn't authority in federal law for there to be a moratorium in the first place. And also that the state needs to have a plan for helping people stay out of institutions and helping people who are in institutions get out of institutions. And that plan involves, in large part, helping people to get services under these Medicaid waivers.
As of today, the state can start processing new waivers, but that may not be soon enough. Assistant U.S. Attorneys Gary Guarino and Richard Pomeroy represented the federal government in court. Judge Burgess has asked all parties to come back to the court with a status report in 2 weeks. K cash for clunkers may be over, but car dealers nationwide are still waiting for their checks from the federal stimulus program. They're also waiting to scrap several hundred thousand vehicles, but that can't happen till they know for sure each vehicle has been accepted by the government as a real clunker. About 700,000 vehicles were sold nationwide during the program. Some of those in Alaska. Dealers in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Kodiak, and Juneau participated. And as KTOO's Rosemarie Alexander reports, they complain about the paperwork, but say cash for clunkers worked.
I drove a couple of them back from the ferry terminal, and that was scary.
Clark McDermott dodges mud puddles in the clunker lot across from Juneau's Mendenhall Auto Center.
A lot of duct tape, a lot of wiring, keeping a lot of bumpers on, a lot of bad tires. A lot of these cars, as soon as they got here, the air went out of the tires. Like that one.
McDermott points to an old Chevy truck with flat tires. The lot is full of gas-guzzling pickups, vans, and SUVs that Southeast Alaskans unloaded during the Cash for Clunkers program. The only Southeast dealership to participate, Mendenhall Auto traded new cars for old throughout the region. Company owner Steve Allwine says his two stores took in nearly 50 clunkers and some not so clunky.
They were things where you went, was that on the road? I mean, it was that kind of inventory. People who had been putting it off. There were a couple where you went, oh boy, should this be in the program, because it was not a bad vehicle. But most of them were the things where you went, yeah, that should be off the road.
Vehicles getting less than 18 miles to the gallon were traded for a fuel-efficient model with a rebate of up to $4,500. According to the U.S. Department of Transportation, nearly $2.9 billion in rebate applications were submitted for reimbursement. The dealers had to front that money. Allwine says it'll be a while before he sees a check.
You know, I guess it'll be a success if we get our money, and we'll wait and see. And frankly, I don't believe that we won't get it.
Alaska Sales and Service in Anchorage and Palmer can vouch for the government.
We have received a couple of payments, two that I'm aware of, one in each of our stores.
Diana Pfeiffer says her company traded dozens and dozens of old vehicles, including a lot of pickup trucks, for new small cars and hybrids.
Our lots are pretty empty right now. The program was a huge success for bringing customers in. There was a lot of people, their vehicle didn't qualify as a clunker under the guidelines of the government, but they bought anyway.
Rick Morrison of Morrison Auto Group even sold a Porsche to a clunker owner. After months of slow auto sales, he says the program brought people into the showroom.
One Saturday, we sold 15 cars in one day. Well, for us, we're a little store, 15 cars in one day, that's a big day. Only one car was a Cash for Clunkers car. So what it did is it woke up and helped amend a little bit of the consumer confidence issue so that people started looking at other things.
Morrison is on the board of directors for the National Automobile Dealers Association. He says Cash for Clunkers also got banks loaning money again.
The credit world has changed and has gotten rid of what I'd call the easy finance programs. You know, the subprime programs are now gone. You don't have a lot of what I call the credit challenge people being able to buy.
The dealers agree the program was literally a bureaucratic nightmare to administer. A pile of paperwork for each clunker. The government's computer system was often down and no feedback. The Alaskans found submitting information was better done between midnight and 4 a.m.
They were totally, completely inept at administrating the system.
That said, the dealers say Cash for Clunkers did stimulate Alaska's economy, and it got a lot of junk off the highway. Back at the clunker lot in Juneau, Mendenhall auto salesman Clark McDermott says a lot of people want to know if they can buy one. Some don't look so bad, but he knows better.
This was a good place for them. A lot of parts hanging off of them.
And once the government checks come in, fluids will be drained, engines seized, and the vehicles towed to the scrap heap to make room for the 2010 models that are on their way, just in time for Alaska's own Cash for Vehicles program, Permanent Fund Dividends. They're out in October. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
The U.S. Department of Defense says a Fort Richardson soldier has been killed in Afghanistan. Army Staff Sergeant Kurt Curtis was shot Wednesday while his unit was supporting Afghan security forces during an enemy attack. He was 27 years old and originally from Utah. His wife and children live in Alaska. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an ambitious plan for a cross-country motorcycle race.
If I'm going from all the way from Key West, from one end of the country, all the way to the other ocean, I want to go to Homer.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
A federal appeals court says a 2007 Beaufort Sea lease sale by the Minerals Management Service was conducted properly. A three-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals on Friday affirmed a lower court decision that said the agency did not violate federal environmental laws. The North Slope Borough and the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission sued the federal agency seeking to rescind the sale, claiming an environmental review done for a 2003 sale was inadequate for the 2007 sale. The borough and the commission claimed increased industry activities should have been taken into account. Alaska Governor Sean Parnell called the decision good news for the state and said outer continental shelf development is critical to Alaska's long-term economic future. The 90-day limit on legislative sessions is getting heavy criticism in the State House, both from members and staff. The measure passed by voters in 2006 reduced the session length from 120 days. A survey this month showed a majority of those polled think the 90-day session does not reduce legislative costs. It cuts down on information, input, and personal access for constituents and doesn't allow for adequate scrutiny of bills. Homer Republican Paul Seaton says the survey supports what he was hearing from members earlier this year.
The 90-day session compressed things to the detriment of constituent input, compressed things to the detriment of being able to have multiple hearings and adequate consideration of bills. And I think that that shows up, and the majority of the House members also felt that 120 days would better serve us.
Fairbanks Republican Jay Ramras is one of the sponsors of the initiative. He says lawmakers have only dealt with the shorter time limit for one session, and they need to give it more time. And he believes the shorter session was a success this year.
Any new program, any new policy has to be formatted. It has to be given time to work, and every program benefits from being tweaked and changed. And it's not to say that 90 days should be put in a lockbox, but I think we should give it a fair opportunity to work. I still maintain that that the legislative branch does less damage to the public good by concluding their work in less time.
The survey got a response from 31 of the 40 House members and from 70 legislative employees. Seaton's report will be given to the Legislative Council, where it will be combined with a list of recommendations from a Senate subcommittee. Subsistence fishers on the lower Yukon River are now up against a new set of fishing restrictions. Earlier in the season, fishing for kings and summer chum was restricted. Now another species is off limits for most days of the week. KYUK's Shane Iverson reports.
Yukon fall chum are genetically distinct from summer chum. They are more oily and calorie-rich, and some families were hoping to increase their harvest of fall chum to make up for a shortage of kings this year, but that has become more difficult.
We've been hit with three whammies.
Nick Andrew Jr. is a tribal administrator in the village of Marshall. He says high fuel prices, poor king harvests, and now fall chum restrictions are going to make this winter even more difficult than last. Fall chums do not have the same dietary significance as kings, but Andrew says they're still an important food for Yupik peoples on the lower Yukon.
Families target those mainly for half-dried, also to be frozen, and still other families target the fall fish for jarring and canning.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game says that the fall chum run is near a record low going back to 1995. They have closed subsistence fishing to just 2 days a week. Area biologist Fred Bew says that the numbers are bad enough to justify a complete closure, but Fish and Game is allowing for some openings.
We're really trying to work around it so that it's the least impact on fishermen. In previous years when the run was a failure, other years we just plain closed fishing altogether.
Fish and Game says that about 210,000 fall chums have passed by their sonar and pilot station. That's well under the escapement goal of 300,000. That sonar missed tens of thousands of kings earlier this season, which contributed to tight fishing restrictions. Those errors were chalked up to debris floating in the river in the wake of massive spring flooding. Bew says that the river has settled and they are now confident that the sonar is more accurate. But Andrew is not so confident.
Mistrust of the pilot station sonar is on a lot of minds.
He says scientists may see a weak run, but traditional knowledge shows something different.
There's a lot of fish out there. When there's a series of pulses that the seals and belugas go after them inland, and that's happened already.
Downriver from Marshall lies the village of Pilot Station. The tribal administrator there, Martin Kelly, says he usually puts about 20 kings away. This year, he only got 5, but he says that was better than most.
Other people here that suffered probably way more than I did.
Kelly says with the current chum restrictions, he's going to focus on catching other food.
I'm just
going
to have to rely on going out and getting other subsistence, like moose or bird and more whitefish.
But salmon often provides the least expensive and least intensive methods for harvest. Kelly supported the king restrictions, but he says hunters will now spend more time on subsistence, and their finances will be stretched thin. He is expecting to see an increase in families applying for temporary financial assistance.
We're going to probably see more and more people applying for those federal and state programs.
Meanwhile, the cohos, or silver salmon, are running strong in the Yukon right now. But Fish and Game says if they opened up fishing for them, fall chum will also be caught. Yukon fishers do have the option of using small mesh gear to target smaller fish. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Construction work is beginning on a new surgery clinic in Fairbanks. The privately developed facility will provide outpatient services. Surgery Center of Fairbanks founder Dr. Mark Wade says the clinic will fill a void in the Fairbanks area healthcare market.
Fairbanks and the surrounding community, I think, is probably the largest community in the United States that doesn't have an ambulatory surgery center present. So by doing this, it's a big boon for the patients here. And more importantly, from the feedback I've been getting from the local community, is that they would like to have a choice. They would like to have a choice if they're going to have their surgical procedure done to be able to go one place or another.
Wade says the clinic is aimed at better serving people needing basic surgical procedures.
An outpatient facility allows children who have to have tubes placed in their ears, people that need have bunions taken care of, or they have dermatological problems or cataract, healthy people that require a procedure to go in to have done in a facility that statistically has a lower infection rate, are cheaper to run because of their lower overhead, and are more efficient.
The new clinic is going up just down the road from its competition, Fairbanks Memorial Hospital, which opposed clinic development through a state certificate of need process and in court, but eventually abandoned the fight. Hospital Chief Finance Officer Jim Lynch says Fairbanks Memorial will remain a full-service community hospital, but there will be financial impacts.
Dr. Wade taking his quick turnaround outpatient surgeries to his new facility will erode the revenue base of the hospital. This is revenue that we use to fund non-competitive patient services like diabetes care, behavioral health, home health care, and other community activities like supporting the Chronic Inebriate Initiative and the nursing school. So it's going to put a bit of a financial pressure on the hospital, but we will be fine and adapt and survive.
Lynch says although the hospital disagreed with the state's determination that there was sufficient need for additional outpatient services, the hospital is moving on.
That issue is behind us. Dr. Wade has been awarded the certificate, and we wish him success in the new venture. But at the same time, we believe that our community-owned, not-for-profit hospital can continue to meet the highest quality and service standards and compete on price with this new facility in Fairbanks.
Dr. Wade says hospitals and surgery clinics typically have a working relationship, and he believes that will be the case in Fairbanks. Wade says the $9 million surgery clinic will employ 13 to 18 people when it opens in the fall 2010.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
This fall, filmmaker Ken Burns tells the story of the national parks in his new PBS series, The National Parks, America's Best Idea. And we want you to share your stories of the national parks. Log on to APRN.org and share a story, photo, or video of your experience in Alaska's 54 million acres of national parks.
Teachers and staff for the Little Diomede School normally start their year with a flight to the Bering Sea Island, but this year they had to find a different way to reach the village that hugs the international dateline. KNOM's Lorelei Kinnean has more.
With no runway for airplanes, the four teachers and one teaching principal expected a helicopter ride, the usual mode of transport to and from Diomede. But instead, they ended up making the voyage by boat.
We were notified at the beginning of August by Evergreen Helicopter that they did not have a helicopter that could transport any passengers due to some mechanical stuff, and they didn't anticipate having a helicopter till the earliest October. So we had no way of getting our staff there, and we immediately started looking at options. So we called other helicopter companies in the state, and either they weren't available because they're fighting fires, or the helicopters were such that they didn't have the pontoons on there, so they couldn't fly over water the 26 miles from Wales to Diomede.
Bering Strait School District Superintendent Jim Hickerson says neither the Coast Guard nor the National Guard had vessels or helicopters available. BSSD was out of options until Norton Sound Economic Development Corporation, the Regional Community Development Quota Group, stepped in with its new 77-foot tender vessel, the Ingolik.
Our goal was to leave Nome by the 19th of August. That was the day that the Diomede staff was scheduled to go back by helicopter, because that would give them Thursday and Friday of the 20th and 21st to prep. We got a call on Tuesday evening from NSADC on the 18th of August and said, yes, we've got the green light, we've got the boat, we've got the captain, and we've got our insurance worked out. Send your staff up, and on Wednesday morning, the 19th of August, we'll leave Nome, and should be about an eight-hour trip, and we'll get your staff to Diomede.
But what was supposed to be a fairly short haul turned into a 26-hour wait. Once the Ingolik anchored off the coast of Diomede, Mother Nature did not cooperate.
They made an attempt to come on shore, and again, the weather was such, it couldn't, so they waited all day, just anchored out there. Finally, it was determined late in the day that it wasn't going to get any better, so they were able to use some smaller skiffs from the community of Diomede. They came out, offloaded staff, and then kept making trips, offloading all of the material supplies. We sent out lots of food from our food service, lots of freeze for the breakfast and lunch program, and so they made multiple trips. Everybody in the community helped out in hauling all the stuff up the hill there to the school and to the housing units.
Hickerson says he's grateful for NSCDC's efforts and creativity, and to the Diomede staff for rolling with the punches.
They worked all weekend. They were very proud that they were able to open school on the 24th of August, like all the other 14 schools in the Bering Strait School District. And as I shared with them, in my years with the district, this is the first time we've ever had to get staff to their duty station, so to speak, by boat. This was a first.
The Diomede School has 30 students enrolled from preschool to 12th grade. In Nome, I'm Lorelei Kinnean.
Organizers of a 7,000-mile cross-country motorcycle race being billed as the Iditarod of Harley-Davidson's are hoping to use Homer as a finish line. They plan to start in Key West, Florida on June 20th of next year and wind up at the end of the road around the 4th of July. However, as KBBI's Casey Kelly reports, city officials in Homer have a lukewarm feeling about the event.
The Hokahe Challenge is the brainchild of James Red Cloud, known as Big Jim, a Harley-riding Vietnam vet who says he's looking for 1,000 true warriors to make the ride with him.
So I kind of got it in my head that, you know, we've kind of turned the whole country into where the world looks at us like we're just a bunch of crybaby pansies. And I thought, you know, out of 6 billion people across the world, and it's on our planet, there has to be 1,000 true men left of like mind that would scream Hokahe and actually mean it.
Hokahe is something legendary Sioux warrior Crazy Horse used to shout while riding into battle. It literally means it's a good day to die. Red Cloud, who lives in South Dakota on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, says the race will be fun, but to make things interesting, he's developed a few rules of engagement.
So 7 checkpoints. Every 1,000 miles, there's a checkpoint. And along the way, you got to sleep on the ground. You can't sleep in hotels. You have to follow the laws of the road and all that. Whoever gets to Homer first gets $500,000 in your fine Alaskan gold.
The entry fee for the race is $1,000, meaning if Red Cloud gets the 1,000 riders he's hoping for, it could bring in $1 million. Part of the money they raise above and beyond the grand prize will go to various charities, many of which help out veterans.
We're huge charity people anyway. I mean, we started the Red Cloud Humanitarian Fund here on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, and we feed lots of people and all that. So we'll just expand it to all the things. Vietnam vets, I'm a veteran. All my friends are Vietnam vets. We thought, well, let's just take all these charities, the ones that we care about the most, and let's give them a bunch of money.
Besides the riders, Red Cloud estimates that about 4,000 family members, friends, and other helpers will be involved at various stages of the race. A production company is planning to film the riders for a documentary-style TV show. Red Cloud and his fellow organizers are asking for the city of Homer's support in pulling off the challenge. But at this week's Homer City Council meeting, council members were cautious about the idea.
I don't want to shut the door on it. I don't like that concept because we have promoted ourselves as a tourist destination, and I think we need to consider that as we're putting ourselves out there, but I think there's other things to be talked about here, too.
That's Councilwoman Beth Wythe, who moved to postpone a resolution expressing support for the Hokahe Challenge and authorizing the city administration to provide assistance. The rest of the council agreed with Wythe and decided to take the resolution back up after Red Cloud and other organizers visit Homer next month and discuss the race with them in person. Most of their concern is over liability issues and the logistical challenge of hosting that many visitors in the middle of an already busy summer tourist season. But Red Cloud says the race participants won't need much from the city.
Just some open arms, man. That's all. I mean, we're going to have people straggling in there. It's going to be a rough run, so there won't be no 1,000 riders come into Homer at one time. You know what I'm saying?
Red Cloud is already working with the Homer Chamber of Commerce to sort out some of the details, such as a party being planned for July 4th to celebrate and crown the winner. He says he spent a month in Homer about 20 years ago, and if it's anything like he remembers it, he can't imagine a better place for the race to end.
Man, what a beautiful place. And we went to Homer and ate that halibut off the back of a boat. when they bring them big fish in. Oh, my gosh, I've never forgot it, you know? And so Homer was like that place that you're touched by in your heart. In some places in your life, you're touched by certain places, you know? And that was just one of them for me. And I said, well, if I'm going from all the way from Key West, from one end of the country, all the way to the other ocean, I want to go to Homer. So we thought Homer would be a great place. And it's just with the people that we met up there at that time, even 20 years ago, was some of the finest people I've ever met in my life.
Right now, Red Cloud says he's still looking for more true warriors to ride into battle with him. Entry forms and details can be found on the race website, hokahechallenge.com. According to the site, the race was to have taken place this summer, but was postponed due to the downturn in the national economy. In Homer, I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Lorelei Kanin in Nome, and Casey Kelly in Homer. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
GrantStation, your fast track to funding on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.